have three things on our agenda, and members, we have a pretty tight schedule because we have to adjourn at 2. So I'd like to welcome Mr. Larry Isaac, who is the president of the Midwest Higher Education Compact. We pay dues to the compact, and President Isaac is going to tell us what we get for our dues.
Thank you, Madam President, or Madam Chair. Thank you for the bill that you've introduced and for the opportunity to appear before you today to talk to you about the Midwestern Higher Education Compact, known as MEC.
And, Mr. Isaac, if I leave the room, I'm familiar with MEC.
Yes,
and
you are,
I'm leaving
yes.
the room because I have a bill up in okay. another committee. So.
I'm going to be speaking from information in this portfolio that you have in front of you with MEC on the cover, so let me get right into it. The Midwestern Higher Education Compact was created in the early 1990s as a result of action taken by the Midwest Legislative Conference, encouraging states to become to create a regional higher education compact to advance cooperation and collaboration in higher education throughout the Midwest. There are three other compacts like this in the country. Those were all created in the 1940s and 50s, and the Midwest decided to start doing this about 1991. Minnesota was a charter member of the compact, passing the legislation very early on. Also, there was a competition for where the offices would be located, and there were a number of cities that were vying for where it would be located, and the Twin Cities prevailed. There was quite a good proposal and press put on by the Minnesota delegation that time. The University of Minnesota was a key part of that discussion to have the compact located in Minnesota, and that's where the commission chose. The compact's governed by a commission of 5 members from each state, 2 from the legislature, and generally 3 appointed by the governor. You'll see on the bottom of, or on slide 4, I guess it is, on the second page, who the commissioners are from Minnesota. The Minnesota commissioners, of course, have been very active as we're located here, and we tend to see each other perhaps more than we do in other states, but you've been very helpful in promoting the compact's efforts and guiding what it is that we do. Now, our overall mission is to advance higher education through cooperation and resource sharing. And early on, the commission decided that this resource sharing part of the agenda was very, very important. You just had a discussion on the floor about cooperative purchasing. Well, this commission got into that many, many years ago when they decided that this was going to be a main core function of this compact. And over the years, there has been significant savings to institutions, school districts, counties, and cities across the Midwest as a result of our cost savings programs. Last year, those programs, and I'm on slide 7 now, saved entities about $31 million across the Midwest from technology contracts and from a very large property insurance program that's now insuring just under $63 billion at institutions across the Midwest. The University of Minnesota has used this program for many years and has saved about $8 million, more than that over the years. You can see on page 9, slide 9.
Mr. Isaac, you should also mention, though, about the K-12 schools that are also
yes.
get savings from the compact, because
yes.
Senator Wieger is the policy expert
yes.
here.
Thank you for reminding me of that. On most of our technology contracts have been negotiated to permit school districts, state and local governments to participate. And, in fact, there's a sheet on the right-hand side of your folder in the back which lists all of the entities that last year purchased off of those contracts, Minnesota entities. So you can see it's very widely used. In fact, last year we show on slide 8 that there were about 100 Minnesota state and local governments that purchased off the contract. They purchased about $4.5 million, saved about $400,000. Now, you look on page 9, you'll see a history there since 2004 of Minnesota's usage of MEC's cost savings contracts. Last year, the number was about $2.2 million. You pay an annual fee of $95,000 to the compact. Last year, your return on that investment was about 25 to 1. We think that's pretty good, and we're just pleased that it is that good and that solid here in Minnesota. There's more information about the cumulative savings and the savings for all of the states in the past 12 months and since all these programs were created. Overall, last year, as I said, our program saved about $31 million in cost savings, and our student exchange program saved students about $14 million for total savings of about $45 million from MEC's initiatives. Now, I just want to make a couple of comments on the cost savings part of it. There are entities that have very good contracts here in the state of Minnesota. Your Department of Administration has done some good things, and some of the institutions do good things. If you're going out for a volume purchase of a couple hundred computers, for example, you might be able to do better by guaranteeing that volume. Or if you're standardizing it, saying, well, here's the two configurations that you can buy from our contract, that's it, you can probably do better in those kinds of contracts. Our contracts are very open-ended to serve a wide array of users. And so if you're buying four or five computers, for example, at a time, our contract should be very, very competitive. So it's not designed to be just serving a narrow usage, if you will, or types of usage, but a very broad audience. And that's where we think we can fill in a lot of gaps that may exist for entities. And that's what we're designed to do. And we find that that is helpful to entities to use that. On page 12, I'd like to point out that we have a couple of new initiatives that are just getting underway. And we have people from across the Midwest, experts in these areas, working on energy and health benefits. That's an issue we hear about often. We received a very generous grant from the Lumina Foundation for Education to look into these. So we have experts in these fields across the Midwest now doing surveys, and we'll be meeting to determine what programs there might be that we could take advantage of across all 12 states in the Midwest. The other thing I'd like to point out to you is that on Governor Doyle's and Governor Pawlenty's initiative, which I commend them for, I also wrote to both governors and indicated that MEC would be willing to help. We may be a way that if they do some really good things, we might be a vehicle that could even expand that to more states across the Midwest. Without creating a bunch of complicated intergovernmental agreements or whatever. We're already on the statutes in 12 states, and we might be a vehicle. And Governor Pawlenty wrote back and said he appreciated it. In fact, he did mention MEC in a couple of his press releases early on when that idea and their proposal went forward. So we appreciate that very much. On page 13, we focus on is student access, and we have a student exchange program. Minnesota has participated in that since it began. Last year, it saved Minnesota students about $5 million that decided to attend in another state in the Midwest. But yet, Minnesota, as you will see on page 14, is actually a net importer under this program. But for those 200 or so students that did use this program in other states, it saved them about $5 million, which, as you know, $5 million in tuition savings is pretty significant. It's between $4,000 and $5,000 a student. Another program that Minnesota is using now is on page 15, our Electronic Transcript Initiative program, which got underway a couple of years ago. Minnesota has started using that program, and where it's so students from high school can send their transcripts electronically to college. We expect usage to be about 25,000 in this coming year and growing. We have three states that are now using the program. We have two or three that are seriously investigating it. We just learned from Michigan yesterday that MEC was selected by an organization there of K-12 school districts, the MEC program, and so we look for implementation there shortly. Kansas is looking at it very seriously, as is North Dakota. We expect that we'll have some movement in those states as well. Finally, Madam Chair, The final area that our commission has asked us to be involved in is policy research. We do a number of things for states in regard to policy research, and I'm going to highlight a couple of them that are in your folder. On your left-hand side of your folder, you'll see a document that looks like this with the spoon and cherry in it. This is the results of a conference that was held here, sponsored by MEC last year, that brought together about 250 policymakers from across the Midwest. Maybe some of you were there. But I'd like to point out that starting on page 7 here, there are some very practical ideas about how do you expand access while controlling costs. That was the theme of the conference. And there may be some ideas there that would trigger you. You're probably doing some good things already. Some of these came from this. This is what these 250 people said are some ideas to address that issue as we move forward of getting more people into and through college. And so you can take a look at it. That's the type of work we do. In addition, we track a number of policy indicators for policymakers. There's another report that has Minnesota on the front of it in your folder there on the left side. And beginning in the middle of that document, starting on page 12, we track about 30, 40 policy indicators for every state and compare them and show you how you're doing. We want to expand this to an international comparison in the future, and so you'll see a number of charts and graphs there. In the document that you have in front of you, we've summarized what that says.
And he has a bill up.
And if you look on page, starting with slide 18 through 20, all those lines and graphs in that report are summarized there in terms of how Minnesota looks in regard to some of the policy indicators that we track. I could go into a lot of those. I could give you a couple suggestions, but your time is limited, and I know that, so I'd be glad to answer any questions at this point.
Well, thank you, Mr. Isaac. You know, I think if you wanted to provide us with those suggestions in another forum at another time, we would really like to.
I'd be glad to do that. You let me know.
So, are there any questions? Yeah, Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Isaac, have you done much on online learning distance learning opportunities?
Madam Chair, we have. We looked into that a couple of years ago. And the committee that oversaw this, again, we try to get experts together from all of the states, put together of what they called at that time endorsed providers. We didn't negotiate any separate contracts, but they looked at what they thought were the best online learning tools out there for higher education entities, and they put together, these are the one or two that we endorse as the highest, and then there was a medium level and then a lower level, to provide guidance, if you will, to institutions what these group of experts thought on it. We did not negotiate a separate contract on it right at this point in time. As you know, the providers have gotten smaller in that area, and that's how we approached it at that time.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, then
thank you,
we'll,
Madam Chair,
we will take Senate File 155 and lay it on the table for consideration.
Thank you.
Any further discussion?
Be a further help.
Thank you. Thank you for your presence. Any further discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much. Next, we will have a presentation from the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership. And I need to say at this time, I'm very sorry about this, that we apparently have to vacate the room by 2:00.
Mm-hmm.
No?
We don't have to vacate.
We have to be adjourned by 2:00. So we have this and another bill presentation. So I see that the real chair of the committee is coming back, so I'll let her speak to the time frame issues that we're struggling with.
Jennifer, just start.
Just start.
Oh. Okay, continue.
Fine, hi. My name is Jennifer Godinez, and I'm very proud to represent the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership. Many of you might know our executive director, when he's not in session, is Carlos Mariani. And when he's gone, when the cat's away, the others will play, right? I'm the interim director, so I'm very proud to be here and represent our entire board of directors. I'll briefly explain what MMEP does, some of our highlights of our programs, and you actually have a few pieces in front of you that highlight our initiatives and the work that we're known for across the state. But our mission is to increase the success of students of color in K-12 and higher education systems in Minnesota. We are a collaborative, which means that we have partner institutions that are a part of our board, and we have community leaders that also represent various cultural communities on our board of directors. The list of our board of directors is in our executive summary of our State of Students of Color report, the piece that looks like this. So I'll let you find those names. But to put it simply, we're so excited to talk a little bit today about the impact of cuts, both on our own budget. We have a small, a minuscule appropriation in terms of a pass-through with the Office of Higher Education. But even larger, the question about budget cuts overall in K-12 education and our access issues in a state that's changing quite a bit in terms of its demographics. I have a few comments about that question, which I believe the committee wanted to hear about as well.
Could you just mention how much you do get from the Office of Higher Education for the members?
Sure. Both of our contracts this year total approximately $90,000, which is about less than 15% of our entire budget. Our operating budget is $700,000. So for every dollar we receive from the Office of Higher Ed, we leverage about $6 from both corporate, community foundations, individuals, and members. Our organization is made up of about 300-plus members, which could be school teachers, university professors, other people who utilize our research and come to our convenings.
Members, we're actually carrying that now as a separate line item in our budget, which is why I thought it would be important for us to learn more about the program.
And as I said, the piece, so that gets to the question of how cuts would affect us. We obviously could gather some corporate philanthropic dollars, but as you all know, that those dollars have also been impacted by our economy. We're planning for sustainability purposes a large membership campaign, and we're also looking at the stimulus funds, pass-through funds through the Department of Education that's specifically focused on cultural communities and access, preparation and access to higher education. So we do feel like there's other sources, but we've counted on the Office of Higher Education contract dollars for a few years now and really do rely on that support. The piece that you have that highlights our work that I just wanted to point out, how people utilize our work is pretty important. The issue of cultural competency, the issue of race equity in education, is pretty much the issue of the day. If everybody here knows the demographic shifts that are occurring, it really means that more of our students that are going to enter our systems look a bit different from the past Minnesotan students that have gone through our K-12. This doesn't necessarily mean that education is going to be any different. The high rigor, the quality should be that and more. It just means that supports and the type of teaching changes to better meet the needs of our students. The State of Students of Color report has been a really critical tool because it highlights what kind of disparities we have in our system and really where the opportunity gaps lie. And one of the pieces that I like to highlight for folks is on page 13, which highlights the aspiration of students of color for college. It's data from the Minnesota Student Survey. And if you'll see, one of the two populations that is often highlighted in terms of academic achievement gap concerns is both the African-American male student and the Latino student. And from the data that we've pulled from the student survey, we see that over 75% of both the Latino males and African-American males in ninth grade aspire to college. So it's these kind of research reports that complement all the other data that's coming out for educators to focus in on populations. And I think aspiration is really key because, as you all well know, we want to start with the students who are most excited about college and are ready to go towards that goal. And we see here that a large majority of our students, contrary to popular myth, our students of color are very much aspiring for higher education. So that's how this tool is very useful. It complements anything that the University of Minnesota develops and puts out there for folks to use, and it complements other research pieces, but it's very unique to MMEP. The other tool I'll point out is the Academic Enrichment Guide that we produce. This is really highlights summer programs and other pieces that are critical to students' progression through the system. We've been developing this tool for 20 years. You'll often speak to leaders in our community of color, and they say they use this tool in order to prepare themselves a little bit better for higher education. And then lastly, the College Access Network, which is what I was brought on to lead, is a statewide network of college access programs, many of which you know about, Admission Possible, Upward Bound. There are several programs out there that have been supporting our youth. What we try to do, which is also a cost savings for the state, is provide professional development, provide support to those programs so they can be sustainable and also continue to serve the students, the subpopulation of students that they particularly serve. We oftentimes lead conferences or summits to teach best practices about how those programs can work in conjunction with the K-12 system. We've also led workshops so that higher ed can partner better with school programs or educators to create stronger college access pathways. So we're really an intermediary that's trying to get systems to be more efficient and get to know what the best practices are of increasing success for students of color into higher education. So I encourage you to look more into the network and how we function in order to provide some cost efficiencies for the state. And last, the question that I believe we were also asked to respond to is, what does this mean in terms of the crisis with our goals of education equity for the state? What does this mean for investments that you'll all be considering, cuts to MinSCU, the impact on the University of Minnesota, the cuts to K-12 education, which all the legislators will have to have some type of opinion about? I wanted to hopefully respond to that question and give some insights from our perspective on race equity. Right now, obviously, smart investments are in tall order. And we feel that the 21st century will need all of our students fully prepared for a global workplace that doesn't exclude students of immigrant families, doesn't exclude African-American young men who may need some more support in school, and it doesn't exclude just the high talent of different cultural community youth and their talent. So I just wanted to highlight that I believe if you have higher standards, and we belong to the P16 Education Council, so we're going that way with higher math standards, higher academic standards, that we should also have some investments in after-school math and science tutoring labs to support some of the students that are obviously not getting enough of that support right now and are failing behind in our systems. We also support the early childhood, all of the advocates that are for early childhood, but we stress one key point, that is really the first college access program for a child, and that investment should not stop there, that we must continue to invest in college access programs that go on through the continuum. And last, we've heard so much about the Pell Grant Aid Program increasing and other amazing opportunities for financial aid. One of the things we're learning in the field is that the information gaps for new demographic communities are quite large. So the way that we've distributed that information in the past may not look the same for the future. We're excited to partner with the Office of Higher Ed on a financial aid literacy campaign, so we're going out and meeting with various communities. All of our trainers speak Spanish. They speak different African languages. We're coordinating this talent so that we can learn how families are going to learn that information in a different way and get the information. So, again, it's one thing for everyone to appropriate more dollars for aid. It's another to get at how does that information really get out to the new communities. So those are just a few concepts in terms of the overall great challenge you all have to decide about funding. In some ways, we need to reconfigure our investments and really highlight where we need to do a little bit more in order to make the systems work. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Senator Roebling.
Very quickly, on page 5, you have a series of questions at the bottom of the page.
In what book? In this book?
In this one, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
2000, Student of Colors. And I'm wondering, are they addressed somewhere else in here? I haven't been able to make it through. Or are these things that you are working to address right now? One of them has to do with integration revenue and then segregation in the charter schools. Have you come to any conclusions that we could get information on yet?
Sure.
Our research, thank you. Our research table, which is made up of various experts around the community and from cultural communities as well, have raised these questions more so to have you all consider those questions and to also have stakeholders in the community consider them. Our next step with this piece would be to have policy briefs that highlight some answers and some research that's already been done around the country or possibly locally around these questions. So to answer that piece about integration funds, I believe there's a few people at our research table that are considering some formal recommendations around that piece. That's not accessible right now, but we're in that process. I believe the legislature is considering what will happen with integration funds in the next couple of years. We'll have policy briefs available around that topic.
Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Godinez. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I believe Minnesota has the worst record for closing the achievement gap. Why?
Well, I think I just pointed out that to give everybody some credit, I think the demographic shift is fairly new for this country. If you look, I'm sorry, for the state. If you look at how many districts had students of color just 10 years ago and how many we have now in the majority of our districts. It's jumped quite a bit. And so to give everybody a little bit of that learning curve, systems are having to learn how to address various diverse learners. It's not for a lack of talent or aspiration from our cultural communities, I can assure you of that. I believe it's a lot of the teacher, their own training, their own background. You've often heard about what teacher prep programs look like. They don't look too different from the same program folks took in the 1950s. So we really have to start training our teachers in different ways to reach students in the different ways that they need to be reached. That's just one answer.
And I think that Senator Wicker and I and others would agree that a prepared teacher is really key to student learning. And we're kind of very interested in the teacher prep programs, both in the Minsky system and in private colleges. And there's some new initiatives. The Bush Foundation is looking at teacher quality, and the Woodrow Wilson Institute is looking at coming to Minnesota to look at how they might impact some of the teacher training programs. And we do have some that specifically focus on the what's called the urban learner, the urban teacher. But it does seem to me that it would be helpful for us as a committee if we really had a better handle on what our teacher ed programs. Actually, Dr. Weidman has been working a little bit on this. Maybe we'll have a hearing after the deadlines and look into some of the teacher prep programs.
And that is a policy brief we plan to produce in the coming year, this issue of cultural competency in teaching. It's often been kind of, I suppose people hear that and think organizations like ours believes white teachers cannot teach students of color, and that has not been the case in terms of research around the country. It is, the question is, do children see themselves reflected in their teachers, and do white teachers understand the variety of diverse learners that they have in the classroom? One great question I heard a researcher ask themselves is, if all of us asked a child to draw a picture of a scientist, what would that person look like? Mm-hmm. So that gets at why competency really matters. And I think women in the sciences, women in engineering understand that, but the culture piece is key as well.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry we don't have more time. Do you want us to ask something?
Well, Madam Chair, I know it's very tight, but as a follow-up, if there might be any school district you can give us a memo on, which school district is doing an exemplary job as evidenced by test scores in closing that achievement gap. And I know there's a couple in Minnesota that are doing a great job, and we have got to learn from those best practices. So if in follow-up, if there might be something as we continue to review this key issue.
Thank you very much, and we'll have you back when we have a little bit more time. We got kind of rushed today because session went late.
Sure. Please look at all these tools, and you have my card to contact me as well.
All right, thank you. Senator Sharon, Senate File 1640. You have some people from Mankato.
Thank you, Senator Pappas and committee members. I know our time is short, and this bill, which I'm presenting 1640 today, is a very interesting project that has many tentacles to it, and it will be difficult in the kind of pressure that we have here today to really fully describe this to you. But I've asked the presenters to focus on what portion of this is here in higher education for you to take a look at. But I do need to orient you a little bit because this the bill that you have in front of you has been amended, so you have a copy of the amendment, the A5 amendment, that went on the original bill. And you should also know that in the original bill, which you have in front of you, which is not the current engrossment because we don't have that for you, the terminology in Section 1, line 1.6, the term technical institute was changed to Technology Institute, and the same on 1.9. The
is
international.
Is this on the amendment or on the bill?
This is on the bill itself. You do not have the most current engrossment, so I just wanted to inform you that the original bill and the amendment already passed in Senator Anderson's committee is in front of you, but it doesn't reflect that the institute is really called the Renewable Energy Technology Institute, not Technical Institute.
So the only change is on line 1.9.
1.6 and 1.9.
Oh, 1.6. Okay. On the title.
And then I have a couple of amendments to offer today. The A1 amendment and the A2 amendment.
We have an A2 and an A5. Is there an A? A1 is in the packet. Okay. Thank you.
An A5.
Okay, Senator Sharon offers the A1 amendment, and the changes on line 1.6 and 1.9 is mentioned to put the bill into the shape she would like it in. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, Senator Sharon.
And do you want to do A2 at the same time?
I think this is more properly in Senator Tomasoni's division.
This is language to be able to move it to Senator Tomasoni's division.
Okay, fine.
I don't know if I want it.
I know, we've been talking. I don't know if I'll get his vote on this.
We move kind of fluidly between divisions. Senator Sharon offers the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Do you also have an A5?
No, that's already been passed, but because you don't see the most currently engrossed, I just wanted you to be able to see that the language was changed from the general fund to the to the Federal Recovery and Reinvestment Act.
Well, why don't we add that since we don't have the engrossed version? Okay, Senator Sharon moves the A5 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, so now we understand that the funds are coming from federal stimulus dollars.
Correct.
And
the appropriation is for the IREDI Institute, and it is an institute that's being formed that's a public-private partnership. And I have a couple of people here. I think I'll just move to them directly. I just want you to know that this partnership has enormous capacity to do a variety of things, job creation, creating and adapting Swedish technology about how to use biomass and to get into small homes and small businesses, renewable energy capacity. It has enormous capacity for manufacturing and for job creation in the manufacturing and for what we're in front of you here today. It has a component to it that provides for the education of students in new careers associated and related to this new industry, and also provides through the Institute access for students in applied research related to renewable energy. So with that, I will allow some brief comments from the people who are here to present, starting with Dr. John Fry, who is the he's going to yield to Mike Davis, who's the president of the Swedish American Chamber of Commerce.
Great. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Just repeat your name, please, for the record.
My name is Thomas Michael Davis, and I'm the chairman of the Swedish American Chamber of Commerce. I will be very brief in my remarks here. I just wanted to point to your attention the handout that I have prepared, which I believe that you have, and initially an article which says that Sweden puts its bets on green tech. A country that is less than twice the population of Minnesota has 3,500 clean tech companies and $14 billion in revenues. And then I will point you to a slide which looks like this, about the sixth page in, into the packet. And that shows that the Swedish gross national product has increased immensely as carbon emissions have gone down. As you see in the top line, bioenergy has gone up greatly. The GNP has gone up greatly, and carbon has gone down. They have invested in green technologies. We have an opportunity now to bring that technology in this public-private partnership to Minnesota, and not only to Minnesota, but to use Minnesota as a base to bring this technology into the rest of the United States. This is an opportunity that we can't lose, and if we lose, it's going to go to one of the other states. A couple of opportunities have been lost. One of them is Vestas, the wind company. They have 23% of the market in wind technologies. They came to Minnesota, toured around, and they ended up putting their headquarters down in Iowa. The same has happened to a company called Chemrec. They own the patents worldwide, a Swedish company, for making DME, which is a form of biofuel from pulp paper companies. They came to Minnesota, many Nordic-owned paper companies here. They toured around. They put a $200 million refinery in Michigan. And that potential for that is to produce 2% of the world's need for gasoline from pulp paper residue. So we lost that opportunity here in Minnesota. We can't afford to do that again. And so what I'm talking about today then is the international aspect of this. This actually has come through a relationship that I brought to the state in 2006, and brought people in like John. And at the end of this packet is my full comments, and obviously I'm not going to read that here. I just want to say that. The bill presently before this committee, Senate File 1640, will, if passed, provide the foundation for placing Minnesota before every other state in the nation in relation to bringing this world-leading Nordic technology to the U.S. market. iReady is key to this effort. It's basically the building stone. Without this, we can't bring in. And the reason is that iReady will standardize and harmonize the European technologies. And if we do that here, we'll do it for the entire United States. It will also educate and train the workforce, and that's why we're here today. And so we need those funds to be able to educate and train that workforce. People can come from all over the country to learn here in Minnesota about these new technologies that we'll have a real step up on. So with that, I'm going to turn over to John and let him explain the local side.
Welcome
Thank you,
to
Madam
the committee.
Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Fry. I'm a Director of Business and Industry Partnerships at Minnesota State University Mankato. This is a Minnesota project. Minnesota State University was selected as a fiscal agent because of our background in renewable energies and our many academic partners across the state. You know, we have working relationships with many of the two-year institutions through our Minnesota Center for Engineering and Manufacturing Excellence that reach from the Higher Education District in the Northeast to Minnesota West in the Southwest. We're working relationship with University of Minnesota Morris because they are doing a lot of great work as well. This is a public-private partnership, and, of course, BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota has been a very important partner here, and they were unfortunate that they could not be here today, but they are hosting companies today for potential location in Minnesota. The education piece is the foundation for many things, but green jobs is one very important element, and that's going to lead us to self-sustainability. This is the three-legged stool that we're presenting, and without the educational piece, it's going to fall flat. The goals is to educate our citizens of all ages. That would be the K through 12 all the way through adults, so that we are capable of making decisions relative to energy and workforce needs. Three common elements was going to be communications, critical thinking, and problem solving. These are going to include the soft and the hard sciences. And ultimately, the goal is to move past the status quo so that we can move into action. The European countries, and particularly Sweden, has some very good technology. They're about 10 years ahead of us in terms of where we are at. And it is time that we try to build an educational program that we don't move all through those 10 years that they've already advanced, but we build an educational program with a lot of hands-on training that will accomplish where they're at and build from there, because we have a lot of bright students in this country and this state, and we have the capacity, and it's just a matter of where we are at. Obviously, one of the things the students will have to work with is the transition from a European system to the United States system, and that would include moving from the metric system to the English system, as just one example. But anyway, as the students will work on this, it's going to be more of a hands-on program. It's going to be more of a regional program than a national program, and it will be one that will provide the basis for jobs and provide the interest for within the students so that they will be available participate in the job market. We have currently, if you take a look at what Sweden is doing, they currently gain 44% of their energy from renewable sources, 24% from biomass. And to be realistic, they have no other option because they do not have any fossil fuel reserves. We are moving in that direction, and pretty soon we will have that same situation. So it's very important that we provide the education so that we have the population, the citizenry, to move forward with that part. We are I know that we're getting short of time, but I just want to say that we will be starting this program with the combustible fuels, and that's very important because 40% of our energy goes into heating buildings, and that would include residential as well as commercial. This is extremely important because really in the United States we have not moved on biofuels for heating and cooling, and this is a great opportunity. There are other parts, but basically what I would like to say in review, and you have my outline, I believe, in front of you, I would just like to say that really we are moving into renewable energy as big business. And we need to educate our workforce so that they are available and ready to move into the many jobs that's going to be created by this. As Mike had pointed out, there are a lot of opportunities that Sweden has already developed, and we would like to be move in there and be competitive with them. So at this point, I would like to urge your support of this bill.
Great. Thank you. Any questions from members of the committee? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't have so much of a question as a comment. And I think this is definitely a direction we have to move. Whether or not we're talking about renewable energy here, we could be talking about any topic. We could be talking about supply chains for businesses, or we could be talking about healthcare or any topic. You know, the fact is that we are moving to a much more lateralized world where we do need to connect across borders through communications, and it's all about sharing information, and I think you mentioned critical thinking and decision making, and that's such a foundational piece of this. We have to really build the infrastructure and the relationships now to be doing that, because if we don't do this, we are going to get left behind.
All right, Senator Sharon.
And thank you very much for that. And in the specifics of this, if we don't do this, we will absolutely lose not just the two opportunities you talk about, but this relationship with Sweden, where they already want to bring technology over here that we can start from year 10 instead of starting from year 1.
Great.
Yes, I'm sorry. There's another point, apparently.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Davis,
members of the committee, I just want to point out that Senator Olsen and Representative Kalin have also been working closely with us. And on April 14th, at 9:30 to 10:30, over in the State Office Building, 500N, Bengt-Erik Löfgren, who is this contact that I brought here in 2006, will be here, and we're having him here to inform the House and the Senate about why we can't miss these opportunities and what Sweden is all ready to bring to us. So.
Great. Well, we'll be sure to have Senator Sharon send out a notice about that. And I actually thought you were going to say that we were all going to go to Sweden and reserve the technology. Mr. Albert wants to go, too. So we've got our trip planned. Senator Thomasson.
You know, back in the day when I was over in Sweden, the advertisements over there were the latest technology from the United States.
It's reverse now. Yeah, we're behind.
No, I think when we're in the United States, it's the latest technology from Sweden.
I see.
When you're in Sweden, it's the latest technology from the United States.
Okay, so Senate File 1640 will be laid over for possible inclusion, and then it also needs to be sent to Senator Tomasoni's division.
Yes, we did. Send I think it you away. Have to just refer it to finance, though, Manager.
Referred to finance. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, any other comments? Then thank you very much, and thank you
Senator.
For your patience today. And I'm sorry we didn't have a little more time to spend with you. That session went late. So the meeting is adjourned.